Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Anna Quindlen is with us, Pulitzer Prize winning writer, number one New York Times bestselling author. Her latest novel, Still Life with Breadcrumbs, is about a photographer who leaves behind the hustle and bustle of New York City, as well as her financial struggles in the aftermath of a divorce, for a much quieter life in the country. She's here to talk about her work and to take your calls on that city-not-city tension that you may experience and life after life in the 30s, the New York Times column that launched her to prominence a few decades back. Anna Quindlen, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian. It's always good to be here.
So the main character in the book is a 60-year-old photographer named Rebecca Winter, who became very famous in her 30s. Rebecca struggles with what it means to be that person, and now she's getting divorced and she's moving out of the city. Why did you weave all those particular strands together?
Well, first of all, it's not the first time that I've had a protagonist who was older. I wrote a novel called Blessings in which the protagonist was in her 80s. And one of the things that I found as a novelist when I was doing that was there's a kind of a richness to a character and a strata to their personal earth that you can bring to someone older that you can't necessarily with someone in their 20s or 30s. So I really loved the idea of returning once again to somebody who had a heck of a history behind her.
And Rebecca Winter, this character, made it big with one photograph, Still Life with Breadcrumbs, which is where the title for the novel came from. But several decades later, she struggles to follow that one big achievement with new work that she's excited about. Are you musing on the fragility of the creative process?
Well, it's not so much the fragility of the creative process. First of all, I'm always struck by the fact that we think something is good because other people tell us it is. Rebecca says that her guiding ethos as a photographer is something that her ex-husband says is ridiculously simplistic. I know it when I see it. But what comes after that, at least with this one photograph for her, is people telling her what she saw. It's a commentary on the trap of domesticity. It's a commentary on the roles of women. She becomes this kind of unlikely feminist heroine. And at the same time, all she can think of is, I took photographs of what was left on my kitchen counter after I gave a dinner party. And there is that notion that we believe something is art, or we even believe something is good because other interlocutors tell us that. I think that's pernicious for consumers, for readers, for viewers, and so on and so forth. But in some ways, it's even harder if you're the artist and people are telling you things about your work that you never imagined to be true.
And the moving out of New York piece, she moves to the cabin in the woods that's in the story, and she's a born and bred New Yorker, and at first she struggles to adapt to the pace of life. Have you gone through this yourself, or what made you look at that New York versus country lifestyle adjustment?
Well, someone who had read the novel said to me, you took on the greatest taboo of all. And I thought they were going to say sex. And what they meant was money. I mean, the only reason that Rebecca takes this ramshackle cabin in the middle of nowhere is because it makes more economic sense for her to sublet her New York co-op, rent this place, which is much, much cheaper, pay, of course, for her mother's nursing home fees, which is another issue, and have a little tiny bit set aside in case she doesn't hit with any new photographs. So it has more to do with money than anything else. But in my personal life, I'm a New Yorker, but I also have, like some New Yorkers, some lucky New Yorkers, a place out in the country. I spend the entire summer there writing and most weekends. People out there, it's very beautiful and very quiet, often say, well, if you had to choose, which one would you choose? And I think they always think that I would pick the quiet, beautiful country. New York is my metabolic twin, and I'm staying as long as I can afford it.
Listeners, if you want to call up and talk to Anna Quinlan, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692 is New York, your metabolic twin, or anything else that you want to say or ask about some of the issues raised in this story. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, her new book, Still Life with Breadcrumbs. Looking back, you were one of the first female New York Times op-ed columnists. You won a Pulitzer Prize for your column Public and Private back in the 90s. But you once told Terry Gross that your job proved itself to be a bit of a challenge because all of the qualities that you need to be a good opinion columnist tend to be qualities that aren't valued in women. Do you think that's still the case?
Sure. Not as much as it once was. But the truth of the matter is there's still a tendency to smack down women in positions of power and influence. I mean, just the other day, Haley Barbour referred to the elected mayor of Hoboken, New Jersey, as a lady mayor. Mm. Now, I don't know any other way to read that than trying to diminish her stature. Mike Huckabee, who normally seems to me pretty well wrapped, made those dumb comments about how women, the Democratic Party thinks women want Uncle Sugar, the government, to underwrite their libido, when my experience is that when we just want prescription plans to pay for our prescriptions. So there is this tendency still to tamp down women's opinions, women's stature in the world.
You said in that same Terry Gross interview that when you turned 50, you realized you didn't care what people thought about you anymore. What brought you to that revelation, and do you think it's changed your writing? I think it's reflected in this character, Rebecca. How has it changed your own approach to your own writing?
Well, I had to care less about what people thought than a lot of other women much earlier than that because of writing a column. I mean, if you're always thinking about what people are going to say, you'll be paralyzed and never write an opinion column at all.
Also, you had a column that was once upon a time pegged to your age, life in the 30s.
Yeah. So I could never, if I'd been so inclined, and I wouldn't have been, I'd never been able to lie about my age. But I did have some of that confidence to begin with. But there's something about the maturational process. And as you grow older, seeing revealed the big lies about women and what they can and ought to do, that at a certain point just makes you kind of fearless. And I encountered this from women of a certain age all over the country. I remember my last book was a memoir about growing older, lots of candles, plenty of cake. And I was signing it at an event, and these three women lined up in front of me and said, "You think 60 is great? Wait till you get to 70. And it was such a wonderful moment.
Laura in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Anna Quinlan. Hi, Laura.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I'm just a big Anna Quinlan fan, and I was hoping, because you talk about the maturation process for all of those who have hopefully matured, your voice and your column would be such a welcome addition to our world. And by ours, I guess I just mean all of us women who read you for so long and would love to see you again on a more regular basis.
Well, thank you so much. It's always so nice to hear that. I try to explore some of those issues that we care about so much as women in the novels, but I totally appreciate that it's not the same as me popping up once a week or once every other week. But I sort of feel like I ran the string out as a columnist. My biggest fear was someday sitting in a restaurant and hearing someone behind me say, "Do you remember when Anna Quinlan was good?" Because I'd stayed too long at the fair. And I feel like both at The Times and at Newsweek, I left at the top of my game. And while I really appreciate that maybe that doesn't work so well for some of my readers, it's really worked well for me.
Laura, thank you for your call. And I could tell Anna appreciates your fandom. And Joanne in Astoria, you're on WNYC. Hi, Joanne.
Hey, Brian. This is Joanne Basalt. of Curtis and Roman.
Uh-huh. I remember your family, right? Our kids played youth soccer together a few years ago. Uh-huh.
Yep. And this topic just, I have not read your books, Anna. I'm definitely going to read this one. The kids are both gone. I am single, and I'm ready to leave New York City and start an entirely new life. So this is really, this subject really touches on me. And I think a woman who raises kids and, you know, takes care of everything for, you know, 18 years is really hard to let go and move on out of New York City, even though I really like the countryside.
So it's a, is the tension in you between the qualities of life in the city by yourself and the qualities of life in the country?
Yeah, I definitely look forward to being able really close to the things I love to do, like hike and ride my bike, which is so difficult here. But on the other hand, I don't know how I will ever let go of New York City.
So, advice for our caller?
You know, I don't have any advice except that I hear her about the kids leaving. I mean, all of us who raised kids and worked at the same time had these lives that were so unbelievably jam-packed that at the end of the day you would think, did I ever get a chance to go to the bathroom? And then whiz, bam, boom, in the space of a couple of years, it's all gone. I'm really lucky. All three of my grown-up kids live in New York, so there still tend to be half-empty cereal bowls left in the sink at odd moments. But for a couple of years after my kids were out of the house, my husband finally pointed out to me that the meals I was cooking were suitable for about eight people as opposed to two people. And I think wrapping your mind around that change in your life is really challenging.
And that caller, she was a darn good soccer coach.
I'll oh, yeah?
So, Joanne, good luck to you. Yeah, and in your memoir, your 2012 memoir, Lots of Candles, Plenty of Cake, which you referred to before, you wrote about your own country house, but also the stuff that you've accumulated in your lifetime that fills both the house and your main home in the city. And the stuff idea seems to creep into the new book, too. Your character, Rebecca, for example, there's a line about her alarm clock. Quote, like much of what constituted Rebecca's life at the moment, the clock had been with her far past the time when it was current or useful.
Yes, it's absolutely true because she shows up at this cabin and, of course, she's a photographer and she says, I can't believe I took this place based on photographs because, of course, the photographs are totally deceptive. The place is kind of a wreck and there are no outlets in the bedroom. And she has a very old clock that needs to be plugged in and no place to plug it in. She quickly discovers that all of her clothes are unsuitable. And therefore, before she knows it, she's shopping at big box stores for battery-operated clocks and blue jeans.
At the beginning of the book, Rebecca fears her editor, who always tells her, everyone's waiting to see what you do next, which recalls what you said a few minutes ago about not wanting to stay past your welcome because maybe you had nothing left to do next as a columnist. But we also read in preparation for our conversation today your essay from the Wall Street Journal a few years back, The Agony of Writing, where you said one of the ways you keep yourself motivated as a novelist is you put a totem on your desk to help you fall back into the story. And so for one of your books, you used an old Hamilton wristwatch, for example. Which is more agonizing, writing a column or writing a novel?
Oh, it's much more agonizing to write a novel because with a column, you have immediate gratification. You write the column and you throw it out there and either you get no response and think, I live to fight another day next week, or you get a huge response and feel connected to all of these thousands of readers. I feel connected to readers all the time when I publish a novel, but it only happens every couple of years. And what happens is that when you're about halfway through it, when it's way too late to turn back. You suddenly have the thought that it's a disaster and you've wasted your life. And you have no way of checking that against any kind of objective reality. So the columns, I mean, I've been doing columns since I was in my late 20s. So if I don't know how to do it now, that's a disaster. But there is that kind of immediacy to newspaper and magazine work that you just don't have with a novel.
Anna Quinlan's new novel is Still Life with Breadcrumbs. And folks, if you want to see her, Anna Quinlan will be interviewed by Katie Couric tomorrow night at 7 at the Barnes & Noble at Union Square. Now, the event space opens at 5 o'clock for the 7 o'clock interview. So I think you have a few fans out there. And priority seating will go to those who buy the book. So thems are the rules, and that's the time and place tomorrow night at 7. Katie Couric interviewing Anna Quinlan at the Barnes & Noble at Union Square. And thank you so much for coming in with us today.
Thanks, Brian. It's always good to be here with you, but it's a little disconcerting to hear the voice I hear on the radio all the time face to face.
Thanks for listening. Thanks for coming.